Hey man, how's it going, y'all? Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I named it after myself, you know, for marketing purposes. It's really just the same old anti-war radio. And, you know, I talk about other things, whatever interests me, but mostly that's just the foreign policy stuff. It's my comparative advantage, just I've been doing it for so long. I remember all the things I hate about it year in, year out. It just, you know, comes easy for me. And I get by with a little help from my great interview guests. Lawyers and writers and reporters and columnists and professors and veterans and geniuses of various descriptions. It's pretty good. David Bromwich, he's one of those geniuses. I threw in the list of adjectives there. Professor of literature at Yale and this and that. But no, it's okay. He's all right, man. I think you'll like what he has to say. And he wrote a thing about Hillary Clinton and Libya that, you know, I would like to see be influential. So have him on to talk about it. That's all. And then as far as the other invites I sent out, there are a bunch of them. And I guess, I don't know. I already got back a no from Mitch Prothero. Too busy. But, that's interesting. Yeah, he said he's in the weeds doing journalism. These things happen. And then Patrick Coburn I invited today. Maybe we'll hear back from him. He's usually good about at least responding no if he can't do it. And I'm trying to get this guy from Cracked on the show who did this great 7 things he learned from reading Dabiq, the Islamic State's magazine, which was really interesting and worth taking a look at. And then Alistair Crook, I mentioned to you guys yesterday. Oh, and I guess I never did hear back from him yesterday. I don't suppose I'm going to hear back from him. What the hell? I don't know. But I mentioned to you guys yesterday that he had written this really important thing that I want you to read at consortiumnews.com, but I'm going to probably go ahead and take you through it today because it's good. But the big news is there was an attack on a hotel, the Radisson Hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali, down there in southern Mali. And I admit that I am not up to the minute in all the details, but pretty easy to imagine that it's the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and their buddies, the Algerian and Libyan-supported Mujahideen fighters. The consequence of the war in Libya in 2011. I've said this before, but I should say it more often so that nobody else steals it and coins it and pretends that they made it up. I'm stealing the term backdraft from the firefighters. There's a Ron Howard movie like that, and I actually never even saw the movie. I guess I should see the movie. But I know what it means. Do you know what it means? Backdraft in firefighting terms? That's when there's a room that's so hot and full of fuel, it's waiting to explode, but it doesn't have any oxygen to burn. But then when the firefighter opens the door, he unwittingly provides oxygen to all this heat and fuel, which then explodes, blam, right in his face. Backdraft. Well, so that's my term for blowback that actually doesn't qualify as blowback. Because blowback means, as coined by the CIA in 1953, when they overthrew the government of Iran, one of the CIA analysts wrote, "Boy, we're going to have some blowback coming down the line from this one." Yep. And anyway, blowback then became, coined to mean not just, hey, consequences, because we already have a word called consequences, but these are the long-term consequences of covert foreign policies, secret foreign policies, so that when the consequences come due, the American people don't understand why. And so then, of course, that makes us extra susceptible to, you know, further folly when we don't even have a chance to correct it because we're never told the truth. September 11th, you look at the images. Those planes seem to come literally. They do come literally out of the clear blue sky, which makes, you know, the perfect mistaken impression of the background. But anyway, so here in Mali, America's taken the terror war, and basically, right after invading Libya, on behalf of the Mujahideen left over from Iraq War II, they moved right on, backdraft, blew up right in our face, and moved into northern Mali, hijacked the local Tuareg revolution, and made their own. In 2013, the French finally invaded, at least to protect the south from the Mujahideen. But the north of Mali, which is the size of Texas, which is huge, I'm from here, is basically wilderness, and there's a mix of Tuaregs and jihadis and French and American special forces hunting them down, supposedly. But that's a fight that's going to just keep going on. Isn't that interesting? We just had Jeremy Keenan, the expert on Mali, on the show, what, day before yesterday, to explain this situation. And now here we are looking at the continuing consequences. And you know, this is the thing. He's the guy I was thinking of. You've heard me say a few different times, I think. I could be wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong. You've heard me say a few different times. It sounds like BS propaganda. It sounds like an imperial excuse for further intervention. But apparently there's really good journalism, actual journalism, that places Boko Haram in Mali meeting up with the Mujahideen. And Boko Haram, which already existed as a reaction to Western imperialism in the first place, which has now declared its allegiance to the Islamic State, in 2012, they went up to Mali and they got weapons. And apparently, you know, I don't know how true this is, but from what I read anyway, they even got an imam, or at least, you know, some religious training and doctrine and excuse making for their behavior, along with military training. And so Boko Haram, which was already horrible, was made that much worse. More backdraft, more consequences of American foreign policy blowing up right in our face immediately. And then, as Jeremy Keenan said on the show the other day, as the French and the Americans, as it's in the headline today, MSNBC, that U.S. Special Forces, along with the French, are, you know, raiding this hotel and freeing some of the captives and or trying to, whatever is the latest news there. But as they fight against these jihadists, they've chased them into neighboring Chad and Niger, which just... You know what, guys? I bet there's one more really badass intervention that the Pentagon could plan where they solve all these problems in a way that doesn't make another set of problems that they have to solve. No, I don't really believe that. Do you believe that? That Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush is going to be able to come in here and undo the mistakes of Bill Clinton and George Bush and Barack Obama Clinton, who is basically just a Clinton himself? Because that's what you would have to believe to support more intervention, as this chain of blowback and backdraft just keeps rolling on and on and on, as further excuse for more, according to them. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Is this thing all right? You know, I had a real audio problem with the Hornberger show last night. Don't count me bumping my finger into the microphone just now. Is it digital distortion? Do you think it sounds like it's my mic or my stuff here? Or you guys think it's the LRN feed? It's just a little crackly and packety? Or what do you think? Somebody in the chat room explain to me what you think the audio sounds like. Sounds good now. Okay, I'm happy to hear that. Thanks, Kit. No problem, Michael. All right. Yeah, hey, it's my show. Listen, it is not okay. This Donald Trump, front runner of the Republican Party, and what he's already admitted that he is willing to do to American Muslims. He would, quote, absolutely implement a Muslim database. Absolutely. He has an instinct for sensing threats, you see. This freaking guy. This is unbelievable. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has voiced support for creating a mandatory database to track Muslims in the United... You know what? Here's the thing. Conservatives, remember how you never really liked George H.W. Bush that much in the first place? Because he was a rhino, right? He was the Eastern establishment. He was a Rockefeller Republican. He wasn't Ronald Reagan, your true conservative hero. He was Richard Nixon. He was Gerald Ford, for Christ's sake. He might as well have been a pinko Democrat. No new taxes. Remember that? Remember how you never really liked him anyway, and that's why so many of you supported Ross Perot and refused to support him when it came to his reelection against Bill Clinton, even after he had murdered a bunch of Iraqis for you, which was highly entertaining. Remember? So it shouldn't hurt your feelings too bad if someone ever just tells you the truth that... Come on, it's not Islam. It's George H.W. Bush. He put bases in Saudi Arabia. Now, what if the Saudis put a military base in Texas? Hey, what if our governor said it was okay? Would that be okay? Or we would kill them. And if it came down to it, we'd crash planes into their properties back in Arabia. Same difference. And they told us for years and years and years, the reason we're attacking you is because you put your bases in our country. And yeah, they dressed it up in religiosity, but it's the same damn difference. It's all George H.W. Bush's fault. That pinko commie, Ted Kennedy, Nelson Rockefeller, Council on Foreign Relations, rhino, center-right, barely Republican, tax raising, big spending, George H.W. Bush. Him and Bill Clinton, who's his adopted son. They're such best friends now. Who carried on his exact policy, bombing and strangulating Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia all through the 1990s. Why in the world should it be difficult for any single American who is not a Bush or Clinton to admit that, hey, come on, this is all the Bush's and Clinton's faults. That's it. It's because of the things that the Bush's and the Clintons did. And again, Barack Obama is just a Clinton. He's no different than Bill. No different than Hillary, his Secretary of State. Maybe a little bit less worse than her, but come on. They're the ones who did this. That's not blaming America. That's not blaming the American people, except to the degree that y'all, sorry, not me, are dumb enough to believe in these people and what they want to happen. So, I don't know. Man up and accept the fact that people that you've always hated anyway are the ones who got us into this mess. And that's not to deny the pseudo-religiosity of the Islamic State, but just look right at the guys who did the Paris attack. They're not religious extremists, they're political extremists. Simple as that. Here's one about how they used to smoke pot and drink beer and have fun with all their friends down at the bar. Same as September 11th hijackers. They weren't Islamic extremists. They weren't so devoted to Islam that they wanted to attack tall rectangles in North America because of, you know, the strength of their belief in hating and destroying good things because of the radicalism of their Islamism. Nah. Wasn't about that. Those guys were all about coke and horrors and suicide attacks. Coke and horrors and killing civilians, just like the Democrats and the Republicans. And the guys that did this French attack, and you can go back through. You know, the same thing for Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center bomber, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his uncle, the second World Trade Center bomber. Those guys, both, all about coke and horrors and good times, especially the uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. White suits and sunglasses at night and hot chicks and good times. Ayman al-Zawahiri, he is not. But that's the point, see, is they're lying this whole time and trying to pretend that this is about Islam. The only thing Islam has to do with it, for the millionth time, is just solidarity. People defending others. And in fact, you know, Michael Scheuer, he's certainly a hawk half the time anyway. But he will tell you, Islam does not mandate offensive imperial warfare against all unbelievers in all unconquered lands. That's not in there. What is in there is a mandate for defensive war. And that if innocent Muslims are being killed, then it is the duty of a Muslim to defend them. But it doesn't necessarily say with violent force, and it certainly doesn't say by killing innocent people who had nothing to do with it or, you know, any of these things. It's all politics. And again, I'm trying to get this guy on the show today who wrote this thing, Seven Things I Learned Reading Every Issue of ISIS's Magazine. There's some cool stuff in there, man. And I actually was like groaned a little bit when he says, I learned in here that they don't like Iran or the Shia. Wow, really? Okay, well, it's a good thing you read it somewhere, I guess. You went right to the source to find that out. All right. I've been cheating, reading Patrick Coburn all this time. All right, hang tight, y'all. I got Bromwich coming up and then much more. It's the Scott Horton Show.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I've noticed, as I'm getting older and older, that at least the weekends come quicker. Right? I'm trying to look for a silver lining there. So my beard turns gray. All right. Hey, check it out, man. I got a chance to talk with David Bromwich again. Welcome to the show, David. How are you?
Good. Good to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to talk with you again. So, yeah, you wrote a thing about Hillary Clinton's Libya is what it's called there. And that's what it's all about, the Democratic debate. And when Libya came up, I'm not sure exactly how it came up. But when it came up, Hillary gave a rousing defense of the Libya war that I actually laughed out loud reading your take on it. But anyway, I'll let you take it from here.
Well, she used all sorts of euphemism, saying that, you know, Gaddafi was deposed, saying when, in fact, you know, when the Islamists, the militias went after him. They captured him. They abused him, tortured him, and killed him. That's not what normally is in people's mind when they hear the word deposed. She said that he had threatened genocide. That suggests that there is one race of Libyans that he meant to slaughter to the last man, woman, and child. But what he said, if the report can be trusted, and that's only a report, was that he would hunt them down like rats in Benghazi, that is, the rebels. Well, you know, for a military leader to say he's going to kill all the rebels in one opposition group is a very bad thing to say, undoubtedly, but he didn't even say he was going to kill non-soldiers, let alone say it was genocide. So, I mean, there were a series of exaggerations like that, and she presented it as a triumphant instance of American prudence and the wise use of military force. She had said in a previous Democratic primary debate that Libya was an ideal example of smart power. I don't think the events themselves or the consequences bear out that description. But the other part of my short column was just saying how surprising it was that Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley had no answer for this. Sanders talked about Iraq as a disaster, quite rightly, and he was against it, as Hillary Clinton was not, and talked about the American soldiers suffering from PTSD. And Martin O'Malley said, with extraordinary vagueness, that Libya was a mess. But, you know, that's what you say when you have an idea. Most people know there's something wrong or something unhappy about the vibes of a word, but you don't know anything about it. So, you know, the Republicans are spouting all sorts of belligerent absurdity about going to war against, let's see, who do most of the Republican primary candidates want to go war against? They want us now to be fighting simultaneously against the Palestinians, Assad's government in Syria, Iran, Russia, and ISIS. I may have missed one or two. So that's the Republican consensus. And the Democratic consensus in the primaries seems to be, let's say as little about it as possible, but Hillary Clinton's nudging over towards the Republican side of things, saying big-time military force by the U.S. is in order now. And the others, and I think particularly Sanders is the more plausible of the other two candidates, just don't care to talk about foreign policy much. So they refrain from saying idiotic things, but they will not say very much.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think part of it is, as you write in the article too, they don't know anything about it. These are the guys running for president of the United States. I mean, I think, David, you and I both could be forgiven if we figured, you know, that they would be at least interested in this kind of stuff if they're putting themselves up for president of the United States. But no, they don't even read. They don't even read about the wars going on.
Well, it takes a little reading, not between the lines, but a little a little extra credit homework to get the facts straight about both Syria and Libya. I think the main suppliers of news, both cable news, the networks, and the major newspapers, have been very weak, not to say misleading, in their reporting, both on Syria and Libya. But it is possible to know a lot, and even this president has spoken some of the truth when he said that it was always a fantasy that the so-called moderate rebels, a group of farmers, pharmacists, etc., could make any dent in the fight against Assad, or for that matter now against ISIS. It's almost a completely fantasized entity, these moderate rebels in Syria, so that our whole policy in Syria has been both, I don't know what to say, chimerical and self-contradictory, because Obama still, in some formal sense, is pledged to overthrow Assad and to defeat ISIS. It may be that that was one of the perception of that was one of the reasons behind the ousting of Chuck Hagel. I mean, if you read stories about that in the week or so before and the week after, one of the things they kept saying was Hagel was bewildered by our Syria policy, and he didn't know how to pursue it or how to defend it until he had a better idea of what the policy was. Well, it sounds like Chuck Hagel was on the right track, and that's why he couldn't be kept on anymore. But anyway, I mean, you can get the right information if you want to. Seymour Hersh wrote an excellent article in 2014, April 2014.
I mean, Robert Perry writes it every day. You know what I mean?
And Robert, like, you're quite right. On Syria, as on Ukraine, Robert Perry at Consortium News, provides lots of relevant facts, and some of the research is original. But that's the gap, I think, between sources, available sources, like what you can find aggregated on antiwar.com and Robert Perry and, Jim Loeb's site,
Loblog.
Yeah, and others, which are reliable and conscientious in their reporting, but the very different balance of information you get in a paper like the New York Times, where bits of the truth peek through in, paragraph 17 of a 20-paragraph
story.
But
you have to already know what the truth is, really, to notice those things.
You have to read, as a friend of mine likes to say, you have to read the Times against the Times. Right. You have to read their previous stories and know just how they're telling you more than they pretend. So I don't think it's easy to get a very clear idea of what happened in Libya or Syria, but it is possible. And if anyone should be responsible for doing such things, it's an intelligent and honest candidate like Bernie Sanders. I'll leave O'Malley out of it from now on, because I don't think he represents much of an opportunity. But I think this is a Democratic Party syndrome, that it is the party of domestic policy, of the modified welfare state, of the old liberalism minus much international consciousness, whereas the Republican Party is the party of, more wars, anti-immigration, jail, et cetera. And it's terrible to say, but that Republican recipe makes people memorize slogans very easily. You get a candidate like, Rubio, who is so fluent, so fast, and so full of assurance about all the things he wants to do, all the guns he wants to shoot off in the world. And he does have some names, some dates, and think he should talk about foreign policy. He's dangerous, shallow, and misjudged to an extraordinary degree. But, he is talking about foreign policy, and Americans are worried about that at a time after the Paris catastrophe, and just looking around and seeing that American power isn't doing what we think it should. So I think a candidate who's going to be aspiring to the presidency ought to have an idea of foreign policy, and this didn't come out in the debate except in Hillary Clinton's very misleading terms.
Yeah. Well, and, Sanders and Rand are the same on either side there, where all this is just the biggest blown opportunity for them, not necessarily to get ahead in winning, but certainly to tell the truth to the people. And that's all I have to do is tell the simple truth to show just how absurd the current policy is. And the one supported by the right wing hawks as well, the Hillary Obama policy. Just even for their own interests, they should be doing it, but they won't.
I think that's right. And Rand Paul seemed on that track at the beginning of his campaign, but he got sidetracked.
One second, David. We'll be right back, y'all, with David Bromwich. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with David Bromwich. He writes for the Huffington Post. He teaches literature at Yale. He's the editor of Edmund Burke's Selected Writings on Empire, Liberty, and Reform. We're talking about the Democrats and in the debate how Hillary Clinton made up a bunch of nonsense, basically, about the 2011 war in Libya and its aftermath. And the other two up there, O'Malley and, obviously, importantly, Sanders, let her get away with it, mostly probably because they never bothered to learn very much about it, to know enough about it to even take advantage of the situation. Just think how well Bernie Sanders could have mocked Hillary Clinton. Oh, it was all justified and would have gone swimmingly if only, huh? Well, let me tell you about Libya, all right? But he didn't come anywhere near doing something like that. And you got to question why. It would be advantage Sanders because that Libya war is an absolute catastrophe. And as you pointed out, was based on falsehoods, no different than the weapons of mass destruction from Iraq War II.
No different. I agree. And I think that, Libya was Barack Obama's little Iraq. The catastrophic effects were smaller, but they were potent, and we haven't seen all of them yet. I wanted to add to where we left off before the break, something about Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders and the missed chances that they both seem to embody. I think one has to put it down to a kind of timidity, though neither of them seems the most timid of personalities. That Rand Paul, for example, went with his party in turning against the Iran deal that the president made, the most clearest ray of light there's been in the Obama years. And Rand Paul, I think, just didn't want to go that strong against the current. And Bernie Sanders had a previous missed chance in the last debate where concerning the personal emails of Hillary Clinton, he said, oh, everybody's tired of that, which is to say we won't talk about that. But one of the things that have come out of those emails is that Hillary Clinton was using sources disputed by and looked on very skeptically by Admiral Mullen in the Pentagon, and that Army intelligence thought that her sources on Libya were poor and that the stories of imminent slaughter in Benghazi were extremely unlikely. She, going on the advice of people like Anne-Marie Slaughter and Sidney Blumenthal and to some extent Susan Rice and Samantha Power, other so-called humanitarian interventionists, Hillary went all out to convince the president against the advice of the Secretary of Defense and against Obama's initial apparent inclination that intervention in Libya was a good idea. I suppose one of the motives behind it was a supposition that America should be seen to be doing something constructive in the Arab Spring. There were high hopes for that then. The Muslim Brotherhood was getting stronger, and they might be elected, as indeed they were in the November-December 2011 elections. So, if the United States had some sort of counterweight, some sort of presence in North Africa, that's making a good statement about our concern for the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And the same misguided logic, I suppose, was behind trying to find, vet, and insert into the Syrian civil war a force that could represent our values. But both of these were just deeply deluded ventures, not based on any ascertained fact. And Hillary Clinton was the ringleader of that tendency within the Obama administration, just as much as the Project for New American Century lobbyists and propagandists were the leaders of it in the Bush and Cheney administration. So she bears considerable blame for what's happening now in Syria with the refugee population all over North Africa and the Middle East. And, you know, it needs to be laid at her door, as well as that of her predecessors, Bush, Cheney, and the others.
Yep. Yeah, and it's really too bad Sanders and Rand both, because I think you just, neither of us could overstate the opportunity that they have here. And, of course, from my angle as a Ron worshiper, I hold a grudge especially against Rand, because his mission here that he apparently never understood was not to become more popular by selling out and pandering and becoming mediocre and just like and running as Jeb Bush, because everybody loves Jeb Bush. His mandate was to continue to sell his father's libertarianism to more and more people from his
right.
bigger and better bully pulpit in the U.S. Senate,
right.
and yes,
well,
even possibly a presidential campaign
yeah.
where he could be changing the world and saying, and again, look how easy it is, audience, to hear when you hear David Bromwich say, hey, here are some facts about Libya. It's the
yeah.
world's greatest facepalm, especially after Iraq War II. You know, do the same damn thing again in Libya the way they've done, and Rand and Sanders both could be absolutely humiliating Hillary Clinton over this right now, and instead they let it skate.
Well, I agree with your contrast that you just drew between Ron Paul and Rand Paul, but I'm afraid the difference is ambition, and ambition is a very corrupting thing. Ron Paul had a particular principle, and there was a kind of truth he wanted to tell, and it was the truth about the horrible misguidedness of our wars and of turning a republic into an empire. And he has kept telling that truth. Rand Paul seemed, you know, on the way to be a candidate who would be doing that when he made his criticisms of the, you know, warrantless mass surveillance of the NSA and when he did his filibuster on drone strikes. There were early and interesting demonstrations like this. But ever since he's become a presidential candidate whole hog, that has faded, and he's become less and less distinguishable from the others except for certain eccentricities. In the case of Sanders, you're dealing with a more considerable and tested and honorable political figure. I mean, there's no, you can't, we've just been driving in Vermont for a couple of trips recently. You can't talk to anybody in Vermont, whether they knew him in Burlington or as a member of Congress or a Senate, who's ever had any contact with Sanders, who doesn't respect him hugely. He is that rare thing, a civic-minded, conscientious politician. But he is a left-wing social democrat in his political orientation, and he doesn't concern himself with foreign policy. So I give him more credit than Rand Paul for honesty, but the net result is very similar, that we don't get criticism of the mendacity at the very top and the bloody wars it's getting us into. Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sitting here talking with the mic off. I do that sometimes.
okay.
Yeah. Don't hang up. Yeah, no, I'm not so sure I buy that. I mean, you may know a lot more about the guy than me, but he just seems like a Barack Obama or a Rand Paul to me, Bernie Sanders. He's horrible, at least some of the time, on Israel-Palestine. He voted to fund the Iraq War over and over again, even though he voted against it, which,
well,
you know, a lot of Democrats voted against it. That doesn't make
right.
him that special to vote against Iraq
yeah.
War II.
I'm sorry to say that seems to be the case with every politician of national rank who has ever been involved in arguing about a war. I mean, Abraham Lincoln made a great speech against the Mexican War, but he did not fail to vote appropriations for
right.
it. So there's, you know, there's...
Well, and on the audit the Fed thing, you know, Ron had the bill in the House, and Bernie had the bill in the Senate to audit the Fed, and then at the last minute, Bernie changed his and, you know, took all the, you know, really audit who's getting the secret bailout money part out of the damn thing and gave them the watered down bill that they didn't really object to. And he just seems like, and you know, I've seen him the way he works
party,
very hard to port
loyalty.
Barrel the F-35. And
there's temporizing in that, but I think of a small time sort. Anyway, maybe you're holding up a higher standard, so I stand back and applaud.
Well, and the F-35 thing, that's the one that really does it, where here's a guy who should be on full jihad against the F-35 as the symbol for all things suicidal about American empire. this piece of crap plane that costs so much, more than any weapon system in world history here. And hey, as long as he can bring home some of that bacon for Vermont, fine. So you know what I mean? Like, he's to me a lot more like Hillary or Obama than he is a Ron Paul, you know, genuine sort of character.
I take the point.
All right, well, too bad. We have more to argue about here.
On that. This is the problem about the ideology of social democracy. We could go into the problem about all-out libertarianism, too. One root problem of which, for me, is that it doesn't deal with the reality of mass society. It's very good in a small town. But, you know, it's true that if a bill or a proposal you know, promises to bring home jobs, it's very hard for a social democrat to vote against it. That is, one of the problems about union attitudes towards environmental protection and global warming. I mean, the unions are very bad when what's up for questioning is the possibility of jobs in the Arctic. If it's jobs for, you know, drilling in the Arctic, the unions will support it, even though they know better.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not a leftist, but sometimes I try to pretend to be from that point of view just for a minute to look at it. It seems like it could be consistent to be absolutely for private sector unions, but absolutely against public sector ones, whether it's police unions or any of the others, because after all, these people have authority over us and kind of under the pretended sort of solution where they're our servants and they operate according to the law. But, I mean, come on. They're, you know, they don't really have the right to those government jobs when that's up to the public to decide, you know, in a way that it seems to me you could make a different argument. And I'm not the best at it, obviously, but
You can cite cases of people who are consistent closer to what you're asking, somebody like Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah. But then you got the private shipyards and the private Lockheed and the, you know, pseudo private corporations that are really part of the fascist imperial combine, the military industrial complex that's, you know, makes all the questions fuzzy. Yeah.
You should add information and security to military and industrial.
Yeah. For that matter, academic and media and scientific and everything.
Oh, no. You're putting me on the floor. Don't make it so hopeless.
Hey, all we got to do is tell the truth, Dave. Hey, listen, you do a great job of that. I really appreciate you coming back on my show.
Okay. Good talking to you, Scott. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's the great David Bromwich, everybody. He's at the Huffington Post. This one is Hillary Clinton's Libya, and really all of his stuff is great. You ought to go back through there and read. Dave Bromwich teaches literature at Yale. He edits Edmund Burke for a career. Okay, this is a guy you need to read. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. I'm trying to get these wars ended. Who says Austrian school libertarians have to be statists on immigration? We should support government goons busting people's heads to keep them out of the country? Well, some have tried to make that case in the past, but now David Hathaway's hard-hitting new book, Immigration, Individual versus National Borders, refutes, point by point, every argument they've made. This is a short, well-written book that shuts down the closed borders argument once and for all. Immigration, Individual versus National Borders by David Hathaway. Forward by me. Buy it now on Amazon.com in both print and Kindle versions. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Hundreds of raids in France. 800-something raids, they're saying on Fox News right now. They've got the military out in the streets, hundreds of people on house arrest. They've declared the right, anyway, to ban all guns in Paris and to confiscate them. Boy. Nearly 800 raids, they're saying, on Fox News right now, not over. And, what a damn mess, dude. I don't know, guys. I admit I'm pretty discouraged. in, I'm split. In a way, seeing even libertarians, some libertarians going, well, I guess we're just, god dang it, it's total war now, man. We're just going to have to go to war against these guys. And god dang dang. Now I'm finally convinced. After being proven right all this time, I've now changed my mind, they all say. Huh? You want the people who got us into this mess to solve it? Come on, man. If you're a libertarian, then you know better than that. And if you don't know better than that, then read Harry Brown's Why Government Doesn't Work. Or just, I don't know, take one or the other index finger and scratch your head for a second and see if that really makes sense to you. They're going to hire the Clintons and the Bushes to solve the problem that the Clintons and the Bushes got us into. And if not them, you're going to have the CIA and the DOD solve the problems that the CIA and the DOD got us into. Let's all stop pretending. Don't pretend things. For God's sake, man. Pretending is for children. We're talking about wars and things like that. Gotta be honest. Now, I'm from here, too. Just because you're from here doesn't mean your government isn't evil. Hell, you know your government is evil. If you're a liberal, then you know the government is evil. And if you're a conservative, then you know the government is evil. If you're an American, then you know the government is evil. But you think it becomes less evil when it's dropping high explosives on complete strangers far away? In that case, hey, politics stops at the water's edge. You shut up, man. Those robots are over there fighting for our freedom right now. If it wasn't for them robots, you'd be speaking German and Italian and Korean and Vietnamese and terrorist language. Them robots are protecting us. And just look at the situation in Syria, where it's not a secret, it's in every paper, there's no way to disguise it, it's all right there. America's been on the side of the jihadists, including the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, Arar al-Sham, and the other Sunni jihadist groups in Syria, for the last 4.5 years, against the secular fascist dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad. They're the ones who have created the Islamic State. The documents from 2012, where they admit that they know that this is exactly what is happening, and the DIA says this is what our allies want to happen, and that if they create an Islamic State in eastern Syria, there's a danger that they could take over all of western Iraq too, which is basically outside of the control of Shiite Baghdadistan at this point. And then it all came true anyway. In fact, what time is it? I should play that clip for you, shouldn't I, guys? This is Mehdi Hassan interviewing the head of the DIA about it.
And a secret analysis by the agency you ran, the Defense Intelligence Agency, in August 2012 said, and I quote, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist, it's not secret anymore, it was released under FOI. The quote is, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. The US saw the ISIL caliphate coming and did nothing. Did you see this document in 2012? Was this come across your table?
Yeah. I paid very close attention
okay.
to all this.
So when you saw this, did you not pick up a phone and saying, what on earth are we doing supporting these Syrian rebels?
That kind of information is presented and
what did you
those become, I argued about it.
Did you say we shouldn't be supporting these groups?
I did. I mean, we argued about the different groups that were there, and we said, you know, who is it that is involved here? And I will tell you that I do believe that the intelligence was very clear. And now it's a matter of whether or not policy is going to be as clear and as defining and as precise as it needs to be. And I don't believe it was.
But in 2012, which was
three years ago,
let's just be clear, for the sake of our viewers. In 2012, your agency was saying, quote, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. Mm-hmm. In 2012, the U.S. was helping coordinate arms transfers to those same groups. Why did you not stop that if you're worried about the rise of quote-unquote Islamic extremism?
I mean, I hate to say it's not my job, but that my job was to ensure that the accuracy of our intelligence that was being presented was as good as it could be. And I will tell you, it goes before 2012. I mean, when we were in Iraq, and we still had decisions to be made before there was a decision to pull out of Iraq in 2011. I mean, it was very clear what we were going to face.
Well, I admire your frankness
on this
subject.
Very clear what we were going to face.
Before we move on, just to clarify once more, you are basically saying that even in government at the time, you knew those groups were around, you saw this analysis,
sure.
And you were arguing against it. But who wasn't listening?
I think the administration.
So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis.
I don't know if they turned a blind eye. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision.
A willful decision to go support an insurgency that had Salafists, Al-Qaeda, and Muslim
Brotherhood. A willful decision to do what they're doing, which you'd have to really ask the president, what is it that he actually is doing with the policy that is in place? Because it is very, very confusing. I'm sitting here today, Mehdi, and I can't tell you exactly what that is. And I've been at this for a long time.
Yeah, man. And listen, I think David Bromwich is right what he just said. That this is how Chuck Hagel, who Obama fought so hard for to have as his Secretary of Defense, this is why he left. He basically apparently told Obama that, listen, you have to tell me what the Syria policy is so that I can do it. Because this whole thing right now, where we're just not saying, but we're fighting on both sides all the time and all this, I'm the one on the hook for it. So come on, Mr. President. Are we overthrowing Assad? Are we on the side of the terrorist guys? We want to back these terrorists, but not those terrorists. Are you going to tell us which ones? I'm out of here. Said Chuck Hagel. The confusion over Syria policy. They call it. He just didn't want to be the one going down in history as the guy who fought for Al-Qaeda in Syria. You would think that Obama would have just said, all right, look here, Chuck. You come out and you say, listen, it sucks. We're not going to support Assad, but we are stopping any support for the rebels because too many of them are terrorists and we don't want to empower them. And then I'm going to say, hey, he's a Republican. And even he is saying that we just can't keep this up. We got to stop. And then you and me, man, we'll stop. And then it'll be horrible, but less worse than this. And then they could have done that. The same way Obama could have said, hey, Gates, you come out and you tell them that you advise me not to do the Libya war. And then I'm going to come out and I'm going to say, see, man, even Robert Gates, Republican Secretary of Defense, told me not to do it, man. And so I thought, well, we better not then. Protect his right flank. He's got, why in the world would you have a Republican Secretary of Defense unless you just wanted to have them because they're better at killing people? Unless you want to use them to protect your right flank when you decline to do horrible things. Stupid, lousy ass President Obama who sucks, who I hate. Anyway, we'll be right back. I got some very substantive stuff for you. You're going to like it. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I mentioned this to you yesterday, but I'm going to say what it says out loud because I think it's so good. It's Alistair Crook, a former MI6 agent. That's the UK's CIA. And a diplomat of some sort, I don't know. Anyway, apparently this guy's a badass, because check out what he wrote. Lost on the dark side in Syria. Let me paraphrase Ad-Rock and clear my throat. All right. When in early August, the Pentagon's former highest-ranking intelligence official, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, said it had been a, quote, willful decision by the West to back the establishment of a, quote, declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, end quote, in order to bring pressure on the Syrian government, and then went on to confirm that the recently declassified 2012 U.S. DIA report on the rise of ISIS in Syria had explicitly warned of the possibility of, quote, an Islamic State being declared, quote, through a union with other terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria. There was almost silence in the mainstream media. No one wanted to touch the live wire of possible U.S. collusion with caliphate forces. But it was clear enough what the American general was saying. The jihadification of the Syrian conflict had been a willful policy decision. And that since Al-Qaeda and the ISIS embryo were the only movements capable of establishing such a caliphate across Syria and Iraq, then it plainly followed that the U.S. administration and its allies tacitly accepted this outcome in the interest of weakening or of overthrowing the Syrian state. Many in the West found General Flynn's comments hard to believe, in spite of his direct knowledge of events. How could this be? It must have seemed so counterintuitive to most viewers or readers, and it is something which touches on a still suppurating wound to the Western psyche, 9/11. But now, with Russia and Iran's military intervention, the Syrian mess in which the West finds itself is only too evident. Russia is providing air cover to the Syrian army, intent on severing the insurgent supply lines from Turkey on the one hand, and to cutting the Mosul to Aleppo supply route on the other, as a precursor to the strategic defeat of the Islamic State. But in face of these actions, Western leaders are widely seen to be prevaricating and even seeming to wish to impede and inflict direct pain on Russians and others' attempts to defeat the radical caliphate forces by endorsing a wave of tow missiles and manpads reaching Syria from their Gulf suppliers. So where exactly does the West stand? The forces which the 4+1 alliance, Russia, Syria, Iran, and Iraq, plus Hezbollah, has to defeat sometimes are not ISIS, but al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, jihadist caliphate forces, in short, that have absolutely no interest in any political settlement other than their own victory. Yet Western leaders shout foul and imply that these are somehow our boys and should not be attacked. The mess that the West is in is apparent to all across the region. The U.S. and its allies are both ostensibly at war with head-chopping radical Sunni forces and in bed with them at the same time. How could this have happened? How can this mess be resolved? The roots to U.S. ambivalence toward fired-up radical Sunni Islam, as I have previously noted, again, I'm reading Alistair Crook, Lost on the Dark Side in Syria from ConsortiumNews.com. The roots of U.S. ambivalence toward fired-up radical Sunni Islam lie primarily with a group of American neoconservatives who formed an influential Cold Warrior nexus around Vice President Dick Cheney and who were obsessed with rolling back Soviet influence in the Middle East and in overturning the Arab socialist nationalist states, who were viewed both as Soviet clients and as a threat to Israel. David Wormser, Cheney's Middle East advisor, stressed in 1996 that, quote, limiting and expediting the chaotic collapse of Baathism in Syria must be America's foremost priority in the region. And yeah, he is talking about Iraq too, ultimately, in the same essay. Secular Arab nationalism should be given no quarter. Not even, Wurmser added, for the sake of stemming the tide of Islamic fundamentalism. In setting the destruction of secular nationalism as its overwhelming priority, America by default found itself compelled to be allied with the Gulf kings and emirs who traditionally have resorted to Sunni jihadism as the inoculation against democracy. But America's and Britain's use of radical Sunni jihadist movements for their greater geopolitical ends was already well embedded long before 1996. When asked whether he regretted the CIA giving covert support to jihadists in Afghanistan 6 months prior to the Soviet military intervention at Kabul's request, President Carter's National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski replied, "Indeed, it was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul." The Soviets intervened on December 24th, 1979. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid to radical Islamic forces was going to induce a Soviet military intervention in Afghanistan. Questioner, despite this risk, you were an advocate of this covert action, but perhaps you yourself desired the Soviet entry into the war and looked to provoke it. Brzezinski, it isn't quite that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. No, they didn't push them, they pulled them. When the Soviets justified their intervention by asserting that they intended to fight against a secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, people didn't believe them. However, there was a basis of truth. You don't regret anything today? Brzezinski, regret what? That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap, and you want me to regret it? The day that the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, "We now have the opportunity of giving to the USSR its Vietnam War." That, of course, is shorthand for no win, horribly destructive, horribly expensive, destabilizing back home overextension of empire. Question. And neither do you regret having supported the Islamic Mujahideen, having given arms and advice to future terrorists? Brzezinski, what is most important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire, some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and an end of the Cold War? Question. Stirred up Muslims? But it has been said and repeated Islamic fundamentalism represents a world menace today. Brzezinski, nonsense. And that's from 1998, which is after, it could have been before the Africa embassy bombing, certainly after the Khobar attack and the first World Trade Center attack, which could have killed 50,000 probably if it had worked, which the FBI could have stopped. Right back in just a sec, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, the article is by Alistair Crook. He's a former British spy. He's writing in consortiumnews.com. It's called Lost on the Dark Side in Syria. And I really liked it. And so I'm reading the damn thing to you here on the show today right now. So how do you like that? Though the principle of using fired-up Sunni jihadism for U.S. geopolitical ends was already well established, the roots of today's American Syria imbroglio lie more with the events of 2006 and 7. The 2003 war in Iraq had not brought about the pro-Israeli, pro-American regional bloc that had been foreseen by the neocon idiots. Sorry, that's my commentary there. It had stimulated a powerful Shia crescent of resistance stretching from Iran to the Mediterranean, and Gulf leaders had become frightened. The Sunni states were petrified of a Shiite resurgence, and there was a growing resentment with our gambling on the moderate Shiites in Iraq, a U.S. government consultant said at the time. We cannot reverse the Shiite gain in Iraq, but we can contain it. It had been Israel's failure in its 2006 war to seriously damage Hezbollah that had been the straw, as it were, that broke the camel's back. So unnerving Israel and Gulf leaders, and it provoked, too, a fierce debate within Washington. Quote, it seems there has been a debate inside the government over what's the biggest danger, Iran or Sunni radicals. Vali Nasser, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, told Seymour Hersh, the Saudis and some of the administration have been arguing that the biggest threat is Iran, and the Sunni radicals are the lesser enemies. This is a victory for the Saudi line. It's also high treason, if you ask the survivors of the 9/11 attack. It's also, there's only one explanation for the reason why. The neoconservatives don't care at all about America. They only care about Israel. And if it comes to even aligning America with the American people's enemies, the Al-Qaeda suicide bombers, then that's what they'll do. If it'll help them one day steal the Litani River. Anyway, that's my little commentary there. It was also, in a sense, a victory for the closely Saudi-aligned Sunni leadership of Lebanon, which over the preceding years had deepened its connections with Sunni extremist groups that espoused a militant vision of Islam, such as Fatah al-Islam, and were hostile to America and sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. The covert, and here he's, when he says, told Seymour Hersh, he's referring to Hersh's great article, The Redirection, from 2007, comes highly recommended. These covert allies of the March 14th, a Lebanese anti-Syrian coalition named after the date of the so-called Cedar Revolution, which of course failed, were viewed by the Lebanese Sunni elite as the putative foot soldiers, war experienced from the Iraq conflict, who could be nurtured and eventually would rise sufficiently in their capabilities to take on Hezbollah militarily in southern Lebanon. They were to be March 14th's Sunni shock troops. In other words, who would contain Shia influence and perhaps even ultimately defeat it. This Lebanese experience was held up to the U.S. administration by those such as Jeff Feltman, then U.S. ambassador in Beirut, as the, quote, pilot strategy for what would be achieved in Syria. March 14th leaders argued that they could safely manage these radical elements, that despite inclining toward an Al-Qaeda orientation, they stood somehow within the broad Sunni tent erected and led by Saad Hariri and Saudi Arabia. The fall of Syria held out the prospect of a wedge being jammed in between Iran and Israel's nemesis, Hezbollah. It was a prospect that enticed the U.S. administration. This time, quote, this time, the U.S. government consultant told me, wrote Seymour Hersh, Bandar and other Saudis, that's Prince Bandar, and other Saudis have assured the White House that they will keep a very close eye on the religious fundamentalists. Their message to us was, we've created this movement, and we can control it. It's not that we don't want the Salafis to throw bombs. It's who they throw them at. They should throw them at Hezbollah, Muqtada al-Sadr, Iran, and the Syrians. They should continue to work with Hezbollah and Iran. Oh, should they continue to work with Hezbollah and Iran? I was going to say, wait, what? If they continue to work with Hezbollah and Iran. Sick and hateful. Not all Saudis were so sure. One former Saudi diplomat told Seymour Hirsch, speaking to Seymour Hirsch, accused Hezbollah's leader Nasrallah of attempting to hijack the state. But he also objected to the Lebanese and Saudi sponsorship of Sunni jihadis in Lebanon. Salafis are sick and hateful, and I'm very much against the idea of flirting with them, he said. They hate the Shiites, but they hate Americans more. If you try to outsmart them, they will outsmart us, and it will be ugly. Again, this is Bush years still, 2007. Cheney and his team nevertheless were intrigued by Bandar's ideas for Syria, but remained cautious. We need to do everything possible to destabilize the Syrian regime and exploit every single moment they strategically overstep. As Cheney famously said, we also have to work, though sort of on the dark side, if you will. In an interview with The Telegraph in 2007, David Wurmser, former advisor to Cheney and John Bolton, confirmed that this would include the willingness to escalate as far as we need to go to topple the Syrian regime if necessary. He said that, quote, an end to Ba'athist rule in Damascus could trigger a domino effect that would then bring down the Tehran regime. These guys, man. Bandar have boasted of his ability to manage the jihadists. Leave that aspect to me. Cheney's then National Security Advisor, John Hanna, later noted the consensus at the time. Bandar working without reference to U.S. interests is clearly cause for concern, but Bandar working as a partner against a common Iranian enemy is a major strategic asset. John Hanna, he's one of Cheney's neocons that lied us into war back in 03, unwittingly for Iran, they thought for Israel. This point, the entry of Saudi Arabia into a major initiative against Syria, also marked the start of a strategic alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia, united in their common hostility to Iran. In fact, the former Saudi diplomat had been right. Neither Hariri nor Prince Bandar was able to control the inflamed caliphate forces with which they were working. What moderates there were simply kept migrating politically toward the Al-Qaeda and ISIS caliphate camp. And CIA-supplied weapons migrated, too. The Syrian conflict was becoming, in character, increasingly jihadist, just as General Flynn was warning as early as 2012, just as we were warning on this show as early as 2011. President Barack Obama is clear that from the outset, he never believed in the notion... Well, and for that matter, I interviewed Seymour Hirsch back in 2007, and I've been covering the support for Jandala and Iran and whatever this whole damn time ever since then, too. God, that was 8 years ago now. Can you believe that? Anyway, the Syrian conflict was becoming in character increasingly jihadist, just as Flynn was warning as early as 2012. President Obama is clear that from the outset, he never believed in the notion of moderates. In 2012, he told Jeffrey Goldberg, quote, when you have a professional army that is well-armed and sponsored by two large states who have a huge stake in this, and they're fighting against a farmer, a carpenter, an engineer, who started out as protesters and suddenly now see themselves in the midst of a civil war, the notion that we could have, in a clean way, that didn't commit U.S. military forces, change the equation on the ground there, was never true, but he pursued the policy anyway the entire time anyway. He just admits that he knew better. That's all. Obama did not believe in the moderates, but was under pressure from the hawks, including his own envoys, Fred Hoth and General Allen, to expedite President Assad's ouster. But the president was adamant that, quote, we're not going to just dive in and get involved. Oh, here he's quoting Obama's denial to Ben Swan. We're not going to get involved with arming our enemies while he was doing that exact very thing. We're going to finish this up on the other side of the break. Hang tight. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing, man. I'm Scott, and it's my show. I hate the government. I want you to hate them, too. And so I talk about their foreign policy, mostly. The very worst stuff they do. The mass murder. The high treason. And I mean against we, the people, not necessarily the state, whatever. But they have sworn an oath to it, so... to us. I'm talking about this article. I'm reading from it. Lost on the Dark Side in Syria. And it's about... and it's by Alistair Crook, who's a former MI6 spy turned diplomat turned critic. Writing here at consortiumnews.com. It's in the viewpoint section today at antiwar.com. And he's going back to, oops, we empowered Iran by invading Iraq. Chalabi was working for them all along, and the neocons, the Israel's fifth column in America, were the Iranians' marks. These stupid idiots who fell for the Iranians' lies that a war against Saddam Hussein was going to be good for Israel. When it was going to be good for Iran is who it was going to be good for. And anyway, so then they said, I guess we shouldn't listen to them. Let's redirect, or let's listen to them as they say, oops, geez, I don't know whose fault that is, but not ours. Anyway, you know what we should do now? Align with Al-Qaeda. And this is the redirection. Biddle's pivot. As Justin Raimondo called it back then, the redirection was Hirsch's article. America started backing bin Ladenites, Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood types in Syria, the Awakening Councils in Sunnistan in Iraq, as well as Jandala bin Ladenites in eastern Iran, and PJAK, who are Kurdish, not bin Ladenite, but Kurdish leftist independent forces, PKK-aligned types. But in Iranian Kurdistan. And so anyway, he's talking about that and bringing us up to date about how the fact is that this project run by Prince Bandar out of Saudi Arabia the whole time, of course, it's the radicals who do the fighting, who get the money, who get the guns, who do the killing because they don't mind dying. And the moderates sit on their fat asses in hotels and make money and fence the weapons to the jihadists. And that's how it's been now. This is the policy Obama quite happily inherited from George W. Bush and has continued all along. I like how in the article he doesn't even acknowledge the change in administration in 2009 because what difference does it make on this? Nothing. All right. So Obama says, hey, look, man, there are no moderates. There's only extremists. So we can't back them. Then he backs them anyway. And he told Goldberg in that same interview, yeah, you're right, Jeffrey Goldberg. Getting rid of Assad would be a great way to weaken Iranian influence. And I'd tell you more about what we're doing to bring that about, but you're not cleared to know that information. So saying right there, we have covert action in effect right there. Of course, Phil Giraldi wrote at antiwar.com in December of 2011 that Obama had signed a new finding authorizing the CIA to ratchet up covert action in Iran and Syria both. But anyway, so continuing here with Alistair Crook, Obama did not believe in the moderates, but was under pressure from the hawks, including his own envoys, Fred Hoff and General Allen, to expedite President Assad's ouster. But the president was adamant that we're not just going to dive in and get involved with a civil war that in fact involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involves some folks who would in the long term do the U.S. harm. That's his denial. That's his outright lie, quoted approvingly here for some reason, that Obama told Ben Swan in the spring of 2012. The answer, as so often, was to move to more covert means in order to mollify the hawks by increasing the clandestine operations in support of the opposition, including the jihadists. Obama. And it is our estimation that Assad's days are numbered. It's not a matter of if, but when. Now, can we accelerate that? We're working with the world community to try to do that. Is there anything you can do to move it faster? Asked Corporal Goldberg. Obama, well, nothing I can tell you because your classified clearance isn't good enough. Ha ha ha. Laughter in parentheses. But plainly, the administration could see how others, not in a clean way, were changing the equation on the ground. Vice President Biden was rather more candid. And then here, I'll go ahead and I'll play the clip of Biden because I have it here and I think it's a little shorter than the version he block quotes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra, and al-Qaeda.
All right, so there's that. And then, paradoxically, John Hanna, perhaps with the benefit of experience, had this to say about Obama's Syria policy. Again, John Hanna, formerly one of Cheney's pet neocons in the separate government he created in the first Bush Jr. administration. Paradoxically, John Hanna, perhaps with the benefit of experience, had this to say about Obama's Syria policy, referring to Obama's June 2015 meeting with Gulf leaders at Camp David. Hanna noted that having, quote, stressed his understanding of the threat Iran poses to the region, quote, Obama let loose with this little gem. The Arabs, according to the President of the United States, need to learn from Iran's example. In fact, they need to take a page out of the playbook of the Quds Force, by which he meant developing their own local proxies capable of going toe-to-toe with Iran's agents and defeating them. The president seemed to marvel at the fact that from Hezbollah to the Houthis to the Iraqi militias, Iran has such a deep bench of effective proxies willing to advance its interests. Where, Obama asked, are the equivalent on the Sunni side? Why, he wanted to know in particular, have the Saudis and their partners not been able to cultivate enough Yemenis to carry the burden of the fight against the Houthis? The Arabs, Obama suggested, badly need to develop a toolbox. God, I hate the way bureaucrats talk. That goes beyond the brute force of direct intervention. Instead, they need to be subtler, sneakier, more effective. Well, just more like Iran. To which John Hanna reflected, quote, think about it. Feeling threatened, desperate, uncertain of U.S. support, and in an existential death match with an intensely sectarian Shia Iran, who do you think the Wahhabis are most likely to turn to as potential proxies in a pinch? AQAP in Yemen? Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria? The Islamic State in Iraq? Impossible, you say. Maybe, but maybe not. The past isn't necessarily prologue, but it is certainly reason to proceed very, very cautiously. The president appears to have a special infatuation with the relatively low cost, under-the-radar utility of black ops, covert action, and paramilitary activities. He also seems eager, even desperate, to ease the burdens of U.S. global leadership by compelling difficult allies to step up and police their own neighborhoods. Combine these impulses together, and it all sounds great in theory as a means of countering Iran, but this is the Middle East, and the coming jihad versus jihad sectarian conflagration is only just getting started, so be careful what you wish for. Wow, that's pretty incredible coming from John Hanna. And of course, he has to sneak in the hawkishness where, oh, it's Obama easing himself of the burdens of leadership, this right-wing talking point. But he sure is right about how dangerous this is. Mostly, I guess, he's probably just providing cover for the neocons trying to pretend this isn't all their damned fault. Hence, the nature of the mess in Syria. Sometimes it's just not possible to square a circle by conceding a little to all sides, to domestic hawks, to the special ops industry, to Gulf allies, whilst trying to hold on to the line of no decisive U.S. military intervention. Semantics and horse trading aside, no matter how frequent the rebranding, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and their ilk, Ahrar al-Sham, etc., cannot be conceived as moderate in a peculiarly British Weybridge sense. Peculiarly. Why can't I say that? Weybridge sense, nor in any other sense. Tom Friedman put it well. That's a strange thing to say. Quote, Obama's been writing his ambivalent... Nah, never mind that. Anyway, there you go.